It was interesting with LBJ, his relationship with his father, whom he adored. But then when he moved to the Hill Country, he became penniless and he had to start taking debt. So he, his family lived in utter poverty, and LBJ decided he could not stand his father. And from then on, treated him like dirt. He had no time for losers, and he considered his father a loser.
It's Shelf Life, and we're doing a deep dive into two wartime presidents with my president-obsessed guest, the actor Dylan Baker. One is Abraham Lincoln, as seen through Gore Vidal's gimlet-eyed 1984 novel. The other is the young Lyndon Baines Johnson in The Path to Power, the first volume of Robert Caro's exhaustive study of LBJ. What connects the two presidents? Find out after.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A U.S. pilot who was shot down over Iran has been rescued in a mission carried out by the U.S. and Israel. But as NPR's Dee Parvez reports, both the U.S. and Iran are claiming victory.
A U.S. Air Force officer who, along with another crew member, ejected from a jet shot down in Iran on Friday, was rescued by U.S. forces Sunday morning. Tasnim News Agency, affiliated with Iran's Revolutionary Guard, says at least five people were killed by U.S. and Israeli forces involved in the operation. President Trump announced the rescue on social media, calling it, quote, one of the most daring search and rescue operations in U.S. history. Revolutionary Guard spokesman Ebrahim Zolfaghori posted a video on X calling the operation an escape rather than a rescue. Dee Parvez, NPR News, Van, Turkey.
Israel says it's attacking Iran's money-making industries. It also says it aided the U.S. with the successful rescue of a U.S. Air Force officer in Iran. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
An Israeli military official, who was not authorized to speak publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity, tells NPR that Israel shared intelligence with the U.S. and halted Israeli strikes in the search area as U.S. troops rescued the Air Force officer whose plane was shot down over Iran. In Lebanon, an Israeli soldier was killed by friendly fire. Israel is now focusing on targeting Iran's steel and petrochemical industries, which are important for Iran's economy and military. Prime Minister Netanyahu said in a video statement that Israel's military strikes in Iran have destroyed the majority of Iran's capabilities to manufacture steel. And Saturday, Israel said it bombed a petrochemical complex needed for manufacturing missiles. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Trump has given Iran until tomorrow to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which carries about one-fifth of the world's oil supply, or the U.S. will strike Iran's infrastructure. Today he renewed that threat. In profane language, he said that otherwise Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day. Gasoline prices have spiked since the war began. David Goodwin is a former energy envoy for the State Department and former Assistant Secretary of Energy. He says even if the strait opens and the war ends, it will take months for prices to go back down.
Assuming there's actually a ceasefire and that Iran is interested in respecting it, it's going to be at least a couple of months. Reopening of the straits will be slow because it may have been mined. Mm-hmm. Also, the logistics of getting all the ships that are trapped in out and the ones that are out in will be slow. Repair. There's been a lot of damage to infrastructure. We don't know how bad. It takes time to get the crew in. There's also restart. A lot of the oil fields have been damaged in Iraq and in other places. You can't turn them on fast with old infrastructure or you can damage the fields.
He was interviewed on NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. This is NPR News. Easter in Jerusalem is quiet this year, not filled with pilgrims in the old walled city. Israeli authorities have imposed strict wartime restrictions, including limiting visitors. Only about a dozen priests prayed inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. During Easter Mass at the Vatican, Pope Leo made a passionate appeal against the conflicts that rage in the world today, saying humans must not resign themselves to what he called this evil. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports.
At an altar at the top of steps laden with flowers in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican, Pope Leo led prayers in Christianity's most joyous celebration.
Each Agnus Dei,
In his service, Leo described Easter as victory of life over death.
Indifferenti alle ricadute di odio.
The Pope warned humans are growing accustomed to violence, resigning ourselves to it and becoming indifferent to the deaths of thousands of people and, quote, repercussions of hatred. He made this Easter a passionate appeal for true peace. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
The Artemis II astronauts are now more than halfway to the moon. They're to arrive Monday, fly around it, and then fly home. The mission is encountering more problems with the toilet, which had malfunctioned after Wednesday's liftoff. The crew has backup urine collection bags until that problem is fixed. They're the first crew to go to the moon since the Apollo mission ended more than 50 years ago. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It was interesting with LBJ, his relationship with his father, whom he adored. But then, when he moved to the Hill Country, he became penniless, and he had to start taking debt. So his family lived in utter poverty, and LBJ decided he could not stand his father, and from then on treated him like dirt. He had no time for losers, and he considered his father a loser.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. When did you first encounter the actor Dylan Baker? Perhaps it was as the brazen wife killer Colin Sweeney in the long-running CBS show The Good Wife. Or maybe it was the FBI bully-in-chief, J. Edgar Hoover, in Ava DuVernay's civil rights-era movie, Selma. Or was it much longer ago, as the monster with the human face, Bill Maplewood, in Todd Solondz's 1998 movie, Happiness? All three of those roles exemplify Baker's attraction to playing morally compromised characters. In the more recent Amazon series, Hunters, he got to play the acme of evil, a Nazi. He has said, "I went into the business because I really enjoyed exploring dark places in human beings. It was always how I searched out roles." But if his screen portrayals often show men abusing their power, his book choices for this episode of Shelf Life show men who knew how to manipulate power for radical social change, and sometimes for ill as well. The first is a novel that reads like history, Gore Vidal's Lincoln, published in 1984. The second is history that reads like a novel, The Path to Power, the first volume of Robert Caro's much-praised and still unfinished history of Lyndon B. Johnson. Dylan Baker, welcome to Shelf Life. It's such a pleasure to see you in the store. We so very rarely get to record in our bookstore in Narrowsburg, and here you are, live and in the flesh.
Thrilled to be here, and I get to look at all of these fantastic books and think about what I'm taking home today.
Well, I have to say, you gave me quite a lot of homework, 2,000 pages in total. We've got a lot to talk about, but I want to just go back to my intro there. You have built this reputation for playing characters with a lot of depth and complexity, but nevertheless, they're usually men who do terrible things. There are exceptions. You've played National Treasure Johnny Carson, as well as on stage the rather benign British Prime Minister John Major. But broadly speaking, you do have a thing for playing baddies. In the opening episode of Hunters, your character Biff Simpson is a Jewish woman who recognizes him at a backyard cookout with the immortal line, "I'm so glad I didn't gas you in the camps. This is so much more delicious."
I think you leave out the nice parts of Biff. I'm good enough to murder her at the end of a long line. First, I murder all my family, my kids, my wife, so they don't have to look at such an awful thing or hear such a terrible line. So that's a rather benign, humanistic part of Biff, I think.
So merciful of you, Dylan. You've played a lot of baddies. You've played some goodies, too. But which of the baddies have you enjoyed most?
Well, you know, that was really fun. There was a play that I have to say I go back to a lot called La Bette. That was on stage on Broadway, my second Broadway show. And in that, I played a sort of a king who made people create drama about me. He just had total control over everyone and what they did. And it was so much fun, but it only ran for a couple of months. So
I did wonder when I did a little bit of digging into your career, how that might feel as an actor to put so much work and invest so much energy into a role for stage that may only get seen by a couple of thousand people over the course of a run versus, say, your role on Hunters, which is seen by millions of people.
Well, it's interesting. We felt like with La Bette that it was a play that really skewered critics. And therefore, when critics reviewed the play, they were pretty brutal with it. And so audiences immediately dipped. But as we went on for the next 4 or 5 weeks, the audience started building and the word of mouth was incredible. And all of a sudden, the laughter started exploding. And by the time we closed, we could have run for another year or two. But the company that was producing us, the really useful company, had decided that it was time to close it because they had made their decision immediately on the reviews. You know, they said after 5 weeks, we'll just close it at this point. And I think we could still be running today, actually.
An early disappointment for the young Dylan Baker then. You spent the next couple of years not working. You struggled for a while to find work. What did that teach you about being an actor?
You know, it's funny. The thing with being an actor is it's kind of like being a cornerback in football. You might let a guy catch a ball over your head, but you've got to forget it immediately and go back to the huddle and cover the next guy. Because if you're thinking about that defeat and the fact that you let somebody beat you, you're going to get beat again. And the same is true as an actor. You can't be thinking about the ones that got away or the play that closed or the movie that didn't happen. You got to get to the next project.
Hmm. And while you're waiting for the next project, what are you doing in the meantime to make money? What kind of jobs were you finding in New York to sort of sustain
well,
you?
Well, there was still quite a bit of books on tape, and I happened to love that. I was lucky enough to read a lot of Jonathan Franzen's books and some of Michael Lewis's books, and I got to read The Grapes of Wrath. And when you read stuff like that, it's not a job. It's the greatest joy of my life, because I think I got into this business because I love telling stories. And those guys wrote pretty good stories.
You are a wonderful reader. I got to hear you just before we sat down now to record the show, recording some scenes from the books we're going to talk about today. You mentioned Jonathan Franzen there, but you are a formidable talent on Selected Shorts, the public radio show in which actors read short stories. Is there a particular author that you've discovered as a result of either reading their work for Selected Shorts or reading their books on tape?
I have to say, the first time I got asked by Isaiah Sheffer to read for Selected Shorts, he gave me Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carry. And I had never read it. And it was one of the greatest pieces of fiction and reporting on what it was like to be a grunt in the Vietnam War that I had ever read. And it transported the audience and definitely transported me. I got to read that, and it remains, I think, my favorite of all of those.
Mm. As you say, Tim O'Brien is very good at writing about war, and you've chosen two books today grounded in extremely significant traumatic wars. I mean, what war is not traumatic, I guess? The Civil War and the Vietnam War. Was war something that you were interested in as a child growing up?
Yeah, I think that's true. I definitely, in terms of my reading material that I picked. I love to read about wars, World War I, World War II, the Civil War. I love going on tours of the different battlefields of the Civil War. And when you actually asked me to look at two books, I found my usual thing, which is the fiction that I read. I may love it, but after a week or two, ask me about the book, Anna Karenina. I know it's something about a train. And so therefore, when you asked me, I said, well, Lincoln is a book. I've gone back to it again and again, and I would happily read again. And I was reading the first of Robert Caro, because that has been something that I've been kind of waiting to get to. And I'm just on to the second one. And they stay with me much better than fiction does, because I'm so fascinated with presidents and their power and how they get there.
That's interesting. You grew up not far from Washington, D.C. Do you think that had any influence on your interest in sort of the dynamics of power in Washington?
Oh, definitely. One of my first jobs out of undergrad was at the Folger Theater in Washington, D.C., and it was housed in the Folger Shakespeare Library. I had a little place two blocks from the theater, a little apartment full of mice, and it was a place where I could exercise my historical Johnson and just walk the mall and look at all the different museums and go to the Capitol and take the tour and go to the White House. I loved it. And presidents, especially, the thought that these guys were there throughout the last 200 and so many years is just amazing.
But you never thought to yourself, maybe I should go into politics? You were always set on a path in theater.
Yeah, I think I had an older brother who was a debater and could speak off the top of his head. And when he gave speeches, it was amazing. And I always thought he might go into politics. He didn't. But I said, well, that's for him. I'm better at memorizing a speech and delivering it. So I think acting is better for me.
When did you first get the acting bug? When was there a moment when you were like, this is what I want to do with my life?
I had gone through high school and I had never acted in a play. I actually auditioned once for the chorus of a musical and didn't get in it. And then I went to college at the College of William and Mary. And the first day that I got there, I wandered over to the theater and they were having auditions for an updated version of Aristophanes' The Clouds. And I swear to you that during the audition, I said, this is the greatest thing I've ever done in my life, and I want to do this the rest of my life.
I get the sense, partly because you've already given me one football metaphor, that you were pretty sporty as a teenager.
That's true. I had great dreams of being a professional sports figure in football, in baseball, and basketball. That was shortchanged for me by having absolutely no athletic talent whatsoever, which was unfortunate. It derailed all of my plans, so I had to come up with a new one.
So then Aristophanes comes calling and you find yourself on stage. What was your path after that?
Basically, for 10 years from the time that I auditioned for that first play until I got out of the Yale School of Drama in 1985, I did a lot of Shakespeare. I did summer Shakespeare, which started in 78, and I just did it summer after summer after summer until I found the Williamstown Theater Festival, and that expanded the different kinds of theater I was doing, but it also gave me an entree to meeting all kinds of amazing people that were working in the business and getting to know different actors. Ed Herman was one of my mentors, and he helped me in every way. I did a two-person play with him. It was the first thing I did in New York, and it was totally out of his graciousness and seeing me and deciding I was somebody who could do this play with him. And it was about World War I. It was about World War I poets, Siegfried Sassoon that Ed played and Wilfred Owen that I played.
I can see that war is going to be a common theme in our conversation today. You've chosen two books that feature war presidents who came to power at precarious moments in the nation's history. The first, as we mentioned, is Gore Vidal's novel Lincoln, and the second is Robert Caro's The Path to Power, about the early years of LBJ. Either Abe or LBJ would be incredibly juicy roles. If you had to choose which one you would rather play, if it was made into a TV series, say, which one would it be?
Oh my gosh, I would kill to play Lincoln someday. One of the first little jobs I had out of school was to play Montgomery Blair or something, one member of his cabinet. And I got to, you know, be in a room where the actor Chris Sarandon was made up to be Lincoln. And ever since, the interpretations of Lincoln always left me very jealous because I'd love to get my teeth into that.
Well, there's a writer's strike on right now, so maybe you can, you know, you can quietly beaver away at your own adaptation of right. one of the many books on Lincoln and cast yourself when the strike is over. You arrive in New York City after Yale in 1985. What was the city like then?
Boy, I came in such a different way than most actors. I had found a place to live, and I had worked in the summer at the Williamstown Theater Festival, and I'd done two different plays, and those two plays moved immediately to Off-Broadway. Started in September and kind of went back to back and didn't stop until I started getting some other work of television and film. Most actors don't get to say that they literally arrive and go to work and rehearsal and do a play off Broadway and win an Obie Award and all of a sudden get Frank Rich talking about you in the paper. So that was a really nice way to start my career.
Yeah, an incredible liftoff. Where were you living at the time?
A series of apartments. Ed said, I think I've got a place over here. I stayed there for a month. And then I found a place up on 110th Street, the top of the park. And across the street was Morningside Park, which is right now beautiful and very nice. But then not so nice in the morning. They'd be pulling, you know, whatever happened the night before, dragging it out of the park. But, you know, New York was always just full of excitement. I loved every minute of it. I can't imagine today how much that same rat hole apartment would be to actors trying to start afresh. I don't know how actors do it anymore.
Now, you are married to an actor, Becky Ann Baker, and you have a child. How did you and Becky meet?
Becky and I actually met in Williamstown in 1985 when I had graduated from grad school from Yale. And we were doing one of the two plays that I ended up moving to Off-Broadway with. We met over that summer, and then we started rehearsals, I would say, early December of 1985, and started dating within a couple of weeks of those rehearsals. And I remember my sister was good. She gave me some advice. She said, look, show romances don't last, so don't think it's going. And when the play ended, we kept going, and we're married in 1987, and we're still together.
You were the exception that maybe proves the rule. The film that brought you to wider attention was Todd Solondz's Happiness in 1998, in which your character is a pedophile who abuses a young boy. It's a role that other actors had turned down. It could easily have derailed your career. It did the opposite, in fact. But did you spend time weighing up the pros and cons first, or just say yes?
I actually was on holiday. Becky and I had flown with our very young daughter, Willa, to Bermuda. In an early actor's life, you don't have any time to think about anything. But here we were on vacation. So I can remember literally going to the beach and just sitting in a chair and going, is this a bad idea to do this job? And I as much as I tried, I couldn't come up with anything to say against it, because the script was so good. The character was so great. And I didn't get offered anything like that. And it is why I got into the business. I love looking into the deepest, darkest recesses of the human being, and this had them all there. And I really liked Todd Solondz, the director. So it was all systems go for me.
You also got to work, I think briefly, because you sort of were ships that passed in the night, but with Philip Seymour Hoffman. What was he like?
Philip came on to Happiness after we had done about a month. We had basically started the shoot and done everything that I had to do, except one scene where I was sitting as his psychiatrist, listening to Philip Seymour Hoffman, this 2-3-page monologue that was incredible that he had been working on, obviously, and it was his first day. So I can remember coming on the set and going, "Hey, how you doing?" To the, "Hey, there's the camera. Hey, there's the boom operator. Good to see you all." And there's Philip. "Hi, how's it going?" He's looking at me like, "Who is this? When we've got to do some work here, we've got to get a film done." We proceeded to do it, and then we got to know each other, and we became friends. And I, you talk about preparing for a role. There's nobody like Philip. And running the Labyrinth Theater, he created writers. He gave actors agency to perform and to believe in what they were doing. He's a huge loss. That's all I can say. We think about him all the time.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, the actor Dylan Baker. We're talking about Gore Vidal's 1984 novel, Lincoln, one of Dylan's favorites among many in the canon of presidential literature. Dylan, one book that is not yet an audiobook and which you'd be a perfect reader for is your first book choice for this episode of Shelf Life, Gore Vidal's historical novel, Lincoln. The subject is in the title, and it was the fourth in his fictional tetralogy, I think is the term that he uses, that also included Burr, about Aaron Burr, 1876, and Washington, D.C. It's a novel filled with detail and incident. You can literally smell the cigar smoke and the taste of bourbon. I know you've just read it a third time in preparation for this episode. How would you characterize your experience this time round versus the first time you read it?
Oh, it's like having drawn a really hot bath and you've got a night with nothing ahead of you and you just get in and luxuriate, I would say. The way that Gore Vidal tells this story and the way he brings in all these different characters and just let you ruminate it. And he's got the whole world of the Confederates, the rebels who were right there in Washington, D.C. at the beginning of the war. And they're openly talking about, "I can't believe." And there goes Abe walking along. Anybody could take a shot at him right now. And then all of a sudden, John Wilkes Booth enters. And the way that Gore Vidal is able to get your collective breath to go, "There he is. There he is." And he's just another actor in his story, but he carries a certain weight to him. It's fascinating the way he's able to craft this book and to craft the political life of Lincoln, the whole cabinet that he's picked that Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote a whole book about called A Team of Rivals, which is also an amazing book. But beyond that, the whole other political side of the Democrats and how they are constantly trying to get Lincoln out of there so that they can restore their power. And then the whole home life of Mary Lincoln and the boys and the two secretaries who become like sons to him, Hay and Nikolai. It's just a masterwork. It really is. And so easy to read again.
You mentioned there in passing Team of Rivals, the Doris Kearns Goodwin history of Abraham Lincoln or biography of Abraham Lincoln. And I know you've also read Lincoln and Gettysburg by Gary Wills. What gives a novelized version of Lincoln like this one by Gore Vidal an edge over a straight up history or biography?
Well, the amazing thing is Gore Vidal, there's a passage late in the book where Lincoln goes to visit some Confederate soldiers that are housed at a house not far from the White House. And he decides he wants to go and say hello to them. And there's no way that Gore Vidal could know anything about this other than a little note saying Lincoln visited some Confederate prisoners at a room. But he creates that room and tells you about it as if he's sitting right there watching the whole thing and makes you feel like you believe every step of the way that that's exactly how it happened. Now, we also are going to talk about the LBJ book, The Path to Power. And Robert Caro, he goes into the LBJ library and he goes through hundreds of thousands of pieces of information, letters and documents and all, so that he can say LBJ at this point was like this, and he did this, and then he went and talked to this person. And it's very hard for Caro because LBJ tried to keep evidence of what he wanted to do, what he planned to do, what he planned to be. He wanted to keep it all to himself, and he didn't write it down. He didn't tell anybody. So Caro had to really put together a jigsaw puzzle in order to create the books that he wrote. Whereas Gore Vidal, he learned about it and then made it happen in front of you. And it's why it's such, you know, delightful reading.
There's a line in one of Gore Vidal's other novels, Washington, D.C., in which a character says, "History is gossip, but the trick is determining which gossip is history." And I felt there was quite a lot of gossip in Lincoln, in Gore Vidal's Lincoln. At the beginning, we get a lot about his bowels, for example. He takes something called blue mass, which is a treatment for syphilis. Did you enjoy the sort of gossipy side of this book?
Oh, you just love it. There's a section where his old law partner, Billy Herndon, comes to visit D.C. And you can tell that Lincoln's wife is, "Oh, no, get him out of here." And sure enough, the secretary, Hay, John Hay, decides to go out for a drink with Billy Herndon. And he starts telling him these stories about Lincoln, about how he goes crazy because he's in love with this other woman before Mary Lincoln, and how he realizes they can't get married and possibly get syphilis. And your head is about ready to explode. It's like, you're talking about Abraham Lincoln. Come on. But yeah, it's the gossip is a big part of the book.
Vidal loves earthy, sort of bawdy humor. And you really get a sense of D.C. as a very different place to the city it is now. The White House is sort of falling to pieces. There are obviously troops on the lawn. There's intrigue and suspense everywhere you turn. The opening scene has Lincoln sort of creeping into D.C., almost like a thief. His bodyguards are afraid he'll be assassinated. You've read actual biographies of Lincoln. How much truth is there behind that story, or did Gore Vidal make it up?
Oh, I think it's very true. And at the time, the Democratic press had a great day with it by saying that Lincoln basically was in disguise when he came into town, because the only way he could come into town was to take a train through Baltimore. And Baltimore and the state of Maryland was Confederate territory. It was definitely a part of the South. And yet, Washington, D.C. is surrounded to the north by Maryland. So when he went through by train, they said he was going to go through on a certain date. He went like a week earlier with his bodyguard, Pinkerton, of the Pinkerton spies, of course, that later were so powerful in Washington, D.C., and also his personal bodyguard, Lehman. And he finally gets to D.C., but there's a couple of great sequences where he's riding around on a horse, and at one point he just bends over to fix his stirrup, and a shot rings out. His hat goes off. He gets the hat. He gallops away and finds a bullet hole in his hat. And I think this happens two different times, that he came that close to getting shot during the war, just when he was riding around Washington. And so that's why Pinkerton started having an entire group of soldiers, Union soldiers, riding with him on either side, in front and in back, so that he wouldn't be as exposed as he was.
Now, you mentioned there Maryland, and there was great concern early on in the war that Maryland was going to vote to join the Confederate States. And this is the first intimation in the book that we get that there's some shadiness to President Lincoln as well. That he's not sort of purely ethical about the way he wants to sort of transact the office of the presidency. We have a small section from the book that deals with that incident or that chapter in Lincoln's presidency. Let's hear it.
Lincoln turned to General Scott, who came to massive attention in his chair. "You're to instruct General Butler in your capacity as general-in-chief that he is to wait upon the legislature, and if an ordinance of secession is passed, he's to interpret this as an incitement to take up arms against the United States, and those legislators who would incite the people to take up arms against us or attempt to seize federal property, as they did when they occupied the Naval Academy, shall be promptly arrested and held in prison at the government's pleasure."
"I shall transmit this order gladly, sir, but what are the legal consequences? I mean, sir, with what are they to be charged?"
"I don't think we need to be too specific. After all, if we were to put too fine a point on it, the charge would have to be treason, and such trials are endless and very hard on the innocent, who might easily be rounded up along with the guilty." Seward was too stunned to say anything. As for General Scott, although his legal training was a half century in the past, he did understand treason trials.
"Oh, you are right, sir, about the difficulty of proving treason. I myself testified at Richmond in the course of the trial of Colonel Aaron Burr, who was no more guilty—"
Seward interrupted the old man without even a show of courtesy. "Mr. Lincoln, you are willing to arrest and to hold men indefinitely without ever charging them with any offense?"
"That's about it, Mr. Seward."
Lincoln's face was uncommonly serene.
"But on what authority?"
Seward felt as if two millennia of law had been casually erased by this peculiar, lazy-limbed figure, now twisted in his chair like an ebony German pretzel.
"On my authority as commander-in-chief."
"But you have no authority to allow the military to arrest anyone they like and to hold them without due process of law."
"Plainly, I think that I do have that right, because that is what I am about to do."
Slowly, the coiled figure straightened out. Then Lincoln addressed General Scott. "Telegraph the order to General Butler."
"Yes, sir."
Scott rang a bell. An orderly entered, received his instructions from Scott, and then departed with the order to overthrow the first rule of law, habeas corpus.
"The most ancient of all our liberties," said Seward with some awe, "is the right of a man who has been detained to know what he is charged with, and then to be brought in due course to trial."
"Mr. Seward, the most ancient of all our human characteristics is survival. In order that this Union survive, I have found it necessary to suspend the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus, but only in the military zone."
Seward whistled very loudly, something that he had not done in years.
"No president has ever done this."
"No president has ever been in my situation."
You're listening to Shelf Life, and that was my guest, Dylan Baker, reading an excerpt from Lincoln by Gore Vidal. Dylan, I really liked the Abe Lincoln in this book. He had a certain charm as well as a shrewdness that I admired. At the same time, Vidal was a famous critic of American foreign policy in particular. Do you think that he's making a point here about how the Civil War and Lincoln's response to it sowed the seeds for the kind of America with a much more muscular interventionist policy during the Cold War in the 20th century.
That's an interesting thought. You're probably right. It's hard for me to think that. I always go to if Lincoln had just had a chance to serve his second 4 years, that he would have found a way to reintegrate the South and the Confederacy into a union. Andrew Johnson, who took over when Lincoln was assassinated, wanted to teach those rebels a lesson and was very harsh on them. And I'm reminded of after World War I, how all of Europe said, okay, we're going to put all these reparations on Germany. And so this never happens again. And of course, it created Hitler. So there's a part of me that thinks Lincoln would have been better equipped to really get into those problems and to try to, if any man could, to lessen them and to try to make people live together. But even Lincoln himself, there's parts of the book where he says, here's the answer. We'll find you a place to go to. There was a place down in Central America that he thought might be good, or in Africa. And he actually had Frederick Douglass and some other black leaders come to the White House, and he talked to them and said, here's my idea. And they said, this is our home. And he said, but you can't imagine that it will ever be harmonious, blacks living with whites. And they said, you were going to have to figure that out.
It's interesting that you say that, because I wondered sometimes in this book if Vidal was sort of suggesting that Mary Lincoln was more of the radical than her husband. There's a scene where Mrs. Lincoln says, they say I am pro-Southern and pro-slavery, and that I try to influence my husband, Mr. Lincoln, who is really, they say, a secret abolitionist. Well, it's nearly the reverse. Do you think that's Gore Vidal playing hard and fast with the truth, or?
I don't think so. I think Gore Vidal really did read Lincoln well, and There was an amazing ability of Lincoln to hold back what he really believed, what his inner core was, and to wait and build public opinion, build a consensus before he came out and created the Emancipation Proclamation and waited to actually make that public and waited to actually have it happen. And people don't remember that the Emancipation Proclamation only freed slaves in the states that were in rebellion against the Union. It did not free slaves anywhere else. But he knew that once you solved each of those states coming back and they had to agree to that law, that once that happened, that there would be an amendment made by all the states to the Constitution saying that there would be no more slavery. And he was far-thinking enough to be able to do that without ever being a firebrand abolitionist. As he says in the book, if I could end this war right now by leaving slavery in place, I would do it. I don't want this war. But if freeing the slaves over there will create an ending to this war faster, then that's what we're going to do.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest today is the actor Dylan Baker. We're talking about two of his favorite books, including Gore Vidal's Lincoln. We'll be back after this.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, presenting Garrison Keillor with special guest Richard Dworsky in the Event Gallery, Sunday, April 19th at 8 p.m. Tickets on sale now. Ticket information at bethelwoodscenter.org.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, the United States, Ukraine, and Russia, and now throw Iran into the mix.
Iran has played such a huge role in enabling Russia's war against Ukraine. So now, when Iran is under attack, Russia is reportedly sending drones to Iran. to help them out.
I'll talk with the Ukrainian journalist Olga Rudenko next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen tonight at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we just ask the question.
Is that statement true?
Get to the point with NPR every weekday morning.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with the actor Dylan Baker about two of his favorite books, Gore Vidal's Lincoln and Robert Caro's The Path to Power, the first of a multi-volume history of Lyndon B. Johnson. Dylan, the first volume of Robert Caro's History of LBJ begins in Texas Hill Country, where Johnson was born and raised. I wonder how much that Texas background, that family that he comes from, shaped the man and ultimately the presidency. What do we learn from this first pretty monumental book, or 1,100 odd pages of it, about the origins of LBJ?
Well, Robert Caro is happy to take a whole chapter about the grass of the hill country in Texas, where LBJ's father decides to move, and how there was no hope for any farmer there because of various problems in the ecology of the land and how they were destroying it and creating massive poverty. I mean, LBJ probably grew up in the worst poverty of any president, even more than Lincoln and his log cabin. And Robert Caro, he tends to go back there and look at it and say, what was it that created this personality that was both able to create the great society and do these amazing things in civil rights, but also hard-headedly taking America's position in Vietnam and increasing it without Congress's approval, that Congress all of a sudden woke up to find themselves in a war that they had no idea about. But that, you know, he was the kind of guy that he was in charge, and what he said went. And he was so crude and tough on anybody that came into his office. And when he was master of the Senate, of course, he would take guys and just start pounding them in the chest. And there's pictures of these congressmen like bent over backwards as LBJ is looming over them and given his position, until the end of it, they're just, okay, I'll do it. And that's how he rammed through so many things as leader of the Senate and also as president. That a way of doing things he learned somewhat from his father, who was also in politics, but he used that in every bit of his life. He used it in college. He used it when he became a congressman. The way that he talked to other people, he made sure they understood. They might not like him, but he often had the back of one of his mentors. He'd have the president of the college behind him so that he could get away with really bad behavior. Or in time, he had Roosevelt behind him. And when Roosevelt had his back, he could get away with so many things and get things done.
What most stood out for you in this book as a low moment for LBJ, and what stood out high moment?
I think the biggest surprise to me, and it might be just because I'm naive, I had no idea how hard he worked to steal elections. And it started in college for the senior class president, a thing that nobody really cared about. And he worked like the devil and used rules to bend them and bring other people in to vote until he got the person he wanted up there. This continued when he got elected to Congress. He used any means he could to get the others out of the way and to use money from people he'd been helping for years. And then when he first ran for the Senate, he worked himself almost to death and certainly on election day got more votes than the other guy. But he made a fatal mistake. He reported all of his big vote-getting districts. He said, yep, send the results in. We've won. We've won. And you never do that in Texas because all of his rivals, they just waited until they knew how many votes they had to steal and then announced that's how many they had. And he learned from that. The next time he ran, he stole enough votes that he got elected senator and stayed in once he got there. The amazing thing about LBJ was that there was no real philosophy to him. There was no ideology to him. The New Deal Roosevelt lovers thought he was the most liberal that he could be. The solid, conservative Republican Texans believed he was conservative. And he kept his real thoughts hidden every step of the way. Even though he talked a lot, made jokes, made big stories, he hid his real beliefs as he went on through congressman, through Senate, and presidency.
Well, let's get a taste of Robert Caro's LBJ, the master political operator, with an excerpt read here by my guest, Dylan Baker.
Johnson had shouted, "Roosevelt, Roosevelt, Roosevelt," to get elected to Congress. In Congress, he shouted nothing, said nothing, stood for nothing. During the 11 years that Lyndon Johnson served in the lawmaking body that is the House of Representatives, few of its 435 members had less to do with the making of its laws than he. Some of the more astute of his colleagues felt that they understood the reason for his silence. Mrs. Douglas, who spent a lot of time with him, speculates on his reasons for acting this way. He was witty. He would tell stories. He was humorous. But he was always aware of being responsible for what he said. He was always aware that what he said might be repeated or remembered. He didn't want someone to come back years later and say, "I remember when you said..." In Washington, everyone tried to find out where you stood. But he had great inner control. He could talk so much, and no one ever knew exactly where he stood.
That was an excerpt from The Path to Power by Robert Caro, read there by my guest, Dylan Baker. You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Dylan, Lyndon B. Johnson was something of a mother's boy. He wrote letters, I think, daily to his mother, or almost daily, right through into his mid-20s. What did you make of that relationship?
Well, it's interesting. His mother was very artistic, very literary, and sort of from an upper crust family in Johnson City. And when his father married her, he brought her down to this almost tar paper shack that they lived in and said, "Now we're going to have a family here." It was dirt floors. It was just as poor as anything you can imagine. And there was no hope of growing any crops in the hill country of Texas because they had already run cattle through there and eaten up everything, and it just wouldn't grow back. There was no water to speak of. So she didn't do the things that other mothers did. She was often sick, but her biggest contribution to Lyndon Johnson was a love of literature, a love of poetry. And he was a good reader. When he started school, he read better than all the other children. But he wasn't interested in doing their lessons. He did anything he could just to get through it because he had his own agenda all the way along the way. There's a wonderful story that he started getting really friendly with these very rich people in his state. And they owned huge building companies, and they wanted to make this dam that they thought would be just millions and millions of dollars. And he was able to find a way to get the New Deal and the FDR programs to fund this dam because he knew it would be great for the state. But it also made these men a lot of money. And there's a scene where one of them says, Lyndon, I've got something for you. It's an oil field and it's all yours. And whatever you get from it, that's all yours. And even back then, when he was in Texas, and I think he was just a congressman, he said, no, because if I have the stain of oil on me, I would never get anywhere. And they looked at him and they said, since when in Texas is having oil in your background a problem? Having a lot of money from oil was just fine. The only problem would be is if you were running for president. And he was already aware of where he was headed for 30, 40 years before he actually became it.
One of the obvious parallels between LBJ and Lincoln is not only their sort of extraordinary political dexterity, but they are two men who probably did more to liberate and enfranchise their fellow citizens than any president between, before, or since, which is part of the great paradox, of course, at the heart of Robert Caro's history of LBJ. How much does that mitigate his failings as a president?
When you look at what LBJ was able to make happen with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, it's almost unthinkable. When he first proposed it, probably 80 to 90% of his own party, the Democratic Party, who was deeply racist, said there's no way that this is going to happen. First, the Civil Rights Act, there's no way. And then, of course, Selma happened and the Edmund Pettus Bridge. It was so public that people were starting to stand up and say something's got to happen. And that's when he turned his party around and got them in line to vote for the Civil Rights Act, which was a feat of amazing dexterity. And maybe only a guy like LBJ could do that. And then when he decided it wasn't enough, and also when Martin Luther King would not leave him alone for 2 seconds, but would get on him and get on him. And what about voting? We still can't vote. We still can't vote. He got the Voting Rights Act through, which was also a feat of Sisyphus. It was almost impossible what he tried to do, and he got it done. Because he was the kind of guy, I think, that said, there's nothing we can't accomplish that hard work and that hard bargaining won't make happen. But that same personality was unfortunately what he did with Vietnam. And he said, there's no way I'm going to be the first American president to lose a war, even though we weren't in a war. We were just literally had 30,000 advisors over in Vietnam looking at what was a local war. And he started on his own escalating that war and putting in hundreds of thousands of American troops in there. And he wouldn't stop. He showed no sign of letting up by the time he left office in 69.
Dylan Baker, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show today to talk about two among your favorite books. I look forward to having you back when you've read volumes 2, 3, and 4 of Robert Caro's Lyndon B. Johnson Tetralogy.
Thank you so much, Aaron. I have total joy in talking about these presidents.
We've been talking about Lincoln by Gore Vidal and The Path to Power by Robert Caro. Both books are published by Vintage. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Gram Books in collaboration with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests like Alan Cumming, John Waters, Joyce Maynard, Ari Shapiro, and Becky Ann Baker. While you're there, consider giving us a review or a rating. It really helps others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings. gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeverSinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
The first Sunday of each month on the Buckaloo Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, is set aside for recent releases as New Music Monthly. We'll hear new British and Irish folk music from stars and from newcomers. So join me, please, for New Music Monthly on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Every weekday morning at 9, NewsHour from the BBC brings you the most important international news stories. NewsHour helps you understand a complex world. Stay informed with NewsHour from the BBC, weekday mornings at 9 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF, Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio.